Welcome to the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
Today, Andrew and I are reconnecting after almost a month hiatus, right?
I know, yeah, it was weird.
It's very weird. Gosh, it's really been almost 4 weeks, right, since our last podcast episode?
Yeah, and then it's been longer than that since when we recorded last.
Right.
We recorded a couple.
Right. So, and since that time, we've both been journeying all over the planet.
And so, just for the record, we didn't kill each other. We didn't break up as friends and kill the podcast after the militarization of the police podcast. I got a couple of emails from you guys saying, "Are you guys still friends?" But you know, it was a vigorous conversation. But
it was an important conversation.
I think it was interesting.
I'm glad that we had it.
I was playing devil's advocate a little bit, but.
Well, yeah. And maybe we'll revisit it at some point.
Yeah, that was worth having. It was a good conversation. But now we are alive. Well, we were just both in Europe for a little while. He in Rome and I in Vienna.
Right, two of the premier cities of our, what do you call it, father continent?
Yeah.
There's some sort of mother continent.
I don't know.
It's not really a sister continent.
It's more like an ant continent now.
An ant?
It's like a...
Well, I was going to say the fatherland, but that isn't quite right, right?
That sounds a little German.
Yeah.
Though we do say in Latin, you know, in patria, you know, like in Os Salutaris Hostia, you know, we say in patria, our fatherland, you know.
Yeah. Or in, what's the quote about, it's pleasant and good to die for one's country, right? Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
Wow, that's right. You got me there. I didn't.
That's a really famous.
I've heard of it.
It's a really famous saying. I don't remember.
I've heard of it.
I'm sure it was like Cicero or something. Original.
My Latin is horrible.
Quote a lot, like on like military. What do you call them? Cemeteries, especially like Civil War era.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
It's so, pleasant and good to die for one's country.
So basically, the podcast you're signing on for today is
Europe.
It's going to be the exact opposite of the militarization of the police podcast. It's going to be we're drinking a delicious cup of coffee, San Sebastian in Colombia, roasted by Novo Coffee.
Roasted by San Sebastian himself.
Exactly. It's actually roasted by Sebastian, the character from Brideshead Revisited.
With his teddy bear.
Aloysius helped him roast it. He's such a naughty bear.
Why is St. Sebastian so popular in Christian art? Do people just like looking at somebody with arrows stuck in them?
I don't know. I mean,
it's weird, right? In Rome, I saw lots of arts.
You know, okay.
And St. Sebastian is everywhere.
You know,
everywhere.
I got a theory about this.
If you don't know the story of St. Sebastian, he was what, like a Roman centurion? No, he was like part of the imperial, what do you call him, Praetorian Guard or something.
You know more than I do about it.
I think he was part of the Praetorian Guard, some sort of high-level military something. Became a Christian, and they shot him with arrows.
Yeah.
It was like firing squad.
He's the guy you always see tied to a post with arrows.
And covered with arrows. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know.
It's weird how those like artistic themes develop and then people repeat them.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. There's a lot of, this might be a whole nother podcast, but there's that one. There's the ecstasy of St. Teresa.
Sure. Well, you know what is really fascinating? Catherine of Siena marrying the Christ child. Have you ever seen this one?
No.
Okay, there's actually quite a few renditions of this at the Detroit Institute of Art. But I saw one, I think just one in Rome in the Vatican Museums. But there's like a little baby Jesus holding a wedding ring and putting it on Catherine of Siena's finger.
Wow.
Right, because it's depicting the scene from her life and her mystical experience where she
weird.
Like mystically marries Jesus, and Catherine of Siena had like a invisible wedding band on her finger that only she could see.
Wow!
But nobody else could.
Well, I don't know. So those first two statues we're talking about it's interesting because I don't know. You see this in other art. There's times when they capture in art the allegory between the mystical life and the life of sensuality or the erotic in the human person, right? And that's a common theme. You know, every great mystic writes a commentary on a Song of Songs. You know, we have Theology of the Body and all that. But it's funny. It's that statue in particular and St. Teresa's. I mean, it looks almost erotic. The look, the way that they're depicted, the look on their face and stuff, and I think that might be something why people are kind of both of them are being the arrow and the other one and St. Teresa. I don't think people are kind of like drawn to the fascination between this suffering and pain and this, you know, kind of this pleasure of the
Well, yeah, that's another thing.
I don't know. I just noticed that.
I think that there's something to that. There are a lot of depictions in Christian art of martyrdom.
Yeah.
It's like there's this one in the Vatican Museums that I was really taken aback by, where I don't remember who it was. Saint started with a B, maybe Saint Boniface, but not somebody else. Anyway, he's like lying down on this table, and there's somebody taking a knife to his belly and like disemboweling him, and it's like he's got this expression of like bliss on his face.
Right, right.
And it's, you're like, whoa, like
they're trying, and obviously they're using an experience. They're using the aesthetics of an experience we can understand, that to try to talk about the intensity and the beauty of an experience that maybe we can all understand.
True.
This mystical union with Christ, even in at the greatest moment of uniting your sufferings with His. I mean, we don't do theology on this podcast, ironically, very often.
But somehow we end up down the martyrdom.
The erotic, and the mystical union of suffering with Christ.
And Catherine of Siena's invisible wedding ring.
But we're planning on talking about coffee and food.
Let's go back
to Europe is what you're signing on for.
European culture. Okay, so let me just
You were in Rome. How was that? What'd you think?
I think you would love Rome, and I think you should move there because in Italy everyone is an artist.
But I'm not an artist.
And you would just fit right in. They would all understand you perfectly. I'm telling you, man, it would be your cup of tea.
I've had so many people tell me that.
So Italy is really funny because it's so beautiful and yet so inefficient and problematic.
And it's dirty too, I've heard.
No. Okay, so
I heard it's gotten better.
I think you're right. I think it has changed a little bit, but they have a different approach to trash, and that is partially because they like people. And what I mean by this is, so for example, in Piazza Farnese, which is one of the main piazzas in Rome that people hang out, tourists go to it, whatever. There's a big statue in the middle. Every day they have a market, right, where people come and sell vegetables and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then at about 3 o'clock, 3:30 or so, the market shuts down, and the trash collector guys show up and they clean up the whole piazza and take all of the trash and leftovers from the market out. And then the restaurants set up their outdoor tables to be ready for dinner. But so there's like this routine that goes on in Piazza Farnese every single day that involves this clean. So like another thing is, in the United States, if you live in an apartment building, you have a dumpster out back, you take your trash out, you throw it in the dumpster, the truck comes and picks it up. But in Rome, that's not how it works. If you live in an apartment, you put your trash in a bag and leave it by your front door outside. And in the middle of the night, the trash people come and pick up those bags of trash and throw them in a truck.
Yeah, that in New York.
Part of it is because their streets are really narrow and they don't have space for things like dumpsters because the city is ancient. It's not like it was built in the past 100 years.
Well, no, but I've heard there was several friends who've lived in Rome, and they said that if you've ever seen one of the famous statues outside, and it's all beautiful and pristine all around it, and the sun setting, they had to send a crew in to clean around that statue first, because if you go see that statue, there's McDonald's wrappers and stuff and cups laying around. Now, but there was literally in Rome, there was a public service announcement where they had famous people, soccer players, singers, actors, trying to get you to change your behavior. And it wasn't, you know, safe sex or don't do drugs or anything. It was literally, hi, I'm famous soccer player. Put your trash in a trash can. Don't just throw it on the ground. So I think maybe in the last 10 years it's been because I've had several people tell me that have lived there, that Rome was this gorgeous city that people just throw their wrappers on the ground.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I did notice littering, but it wasn't egregious. You know, it wasn't like you were wading through trash when you're walking through the streets.
See, it seems like different cities have different things like that, where it's like some cities you go to and they're just dirty. In some cities you go to, I was blown away by Seattle the first time I went there, because it's such a clean city, and partially it's because it rains all the time, and so it washes away a lot of the filth and stuff, you know. But Vienna, on the other hand, I just came from Vienna. Vienna is beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, Vienna is just like, it is really clean and really manicured. It's just gorgeous. I mean, it's just I've never seen a cleaner city.
So I was going to say, one of the things I was most struck about life in Italy was the timing of things, which I think at first I thought it was like, wow, these people are really lazy. But then I realized, no, actually, they just divide their day differently than we
right.
do. So, you know, in our typical American, I don't know what you call it, business week or whatever, everybody works 9 to 5, that kind of thing, or 8 to 5 or 7:30 to 5 or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, this
right?
is Denver. They work 7 to
– well, a lot of people in Denver work, what, 7:30 to 4:30 or something?
I mean, it's weird.
To
it's
try
like,
to beat the traffic or something?
Yeah, it blew me away when I first – when I started commuting in here to open the shop in the morning,
yeah.
I was on the road at 6:30 in the morning and there's all this traffic.
Right, right.
I'm like, where are these people going?
Well, I think a lot of them are tech workers and have flex schedules where their bosses
yeah.
allow them to adjust their schedule to try to beat rush hour.
But yeah, and I know my room.
But anyway,
roommate's a government employee, and he can do
okay,
that.
Okay, so in the United States, we have this 9-to-5 sort of culture, even though not everybody participates in it. But
right.
that's sort of the standard idea. And then you eat a quick lunch, and then you go home and you have dinner with your family.
Right.
Well, in Rome, it's different in that most people start work a little earlier, so at least it seemed, about maybe 8 o'clock.
Hmm.
And you work a long morning and eat lunch at about 1 or 1:15. And usually lunch is the biggest meal of the day.
Yeah.
And so it's, I mean, at least in theory, you have like the pasta course and the meat course and maybe a salad. You know, maybe you have a pasta course, salad, and then a meat course is often I think how it will go, and a glass of wine. And so basically everything shuts down from about 12:30 or so when people need to go home till about 3.
Hmm.
So like, for example, I was visiting a lot of churches in Rome, and all of the churches closed down between about 12:30 and 3 or 4.
Wow.
So you have to do all of your church touring or visiting in the morning or after 4 o'clock or even 4:30, some of them. So people go back. So people have this big meal in the middle of the day, either at a restaurant or at home, and then they go back to work and they work until about 7.
7?
Yeah. Right?
And that's why they have dinner so late.
And then you have a late dinner, but usually the dinner is you know, not as formal. You might not drink wine or you know, it's not going to be as much food as you had at lunchtime. And then that's it. And then you start all over the next day. So at first I was like, man, these people just like want to take a 3-hour break in the middle of the day where they just take a nap or whatever. But if you start doing the math, you're like, wait a second. They're working, say, 5 hours in the morning. And then they're working 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon. So it really does add up to an 8 or 9 hour day. It's just broken up a little bit differently. And they don't have as much time in the evening as we do.
Yeah, we're more like, look, get in, get it done, get back out. And
yeah,
now,
watch TV.
Yeah, and watch TV. Now we're back in home mode.
Yeah.
And we're going to cook this giant meal. And it needs to be on the table by 6:30. And now we're going to eat this giant meal. And then we're all going to hunker down and watch TV until we fall asleep, you know? And yeah, that's a...
I mean, it's really fascinating. And the thing you feel, I mean, I don't know if this is really true, but the thing you feel about it is like, wow, this is not something that could easily be changed, nor is it something that somebody just came up with. Like, they've been
right.
doing this for a long time.
Oh, no, that's definitely the rhythm.
Yeah, I think the American entrepreneur efficiency manager person within me would be like, well, gosh, you know, all these churches make money from the tourists that come through who give donations or whatever. Like, seems like they should try to be open more often or, like,
right.
have people share or do different shifts or whatever. So, but it's like, no, that's not how our culture works. Like, we all have to eat together at 1 o'clock.
Right.
Like, everybody has to do that. So everything shuts down. You know, it's not just like – I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the way the United States used to be on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've never really experienced this, but my parents tell me stories of,
oh, I did,
you know, back
yeah.
in the 50s and 60s, basically absolutely nothing was open on Sunday.
I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and I can
yeah.
remember, I mean, my dad owned a little liquor store when
yeah.
I was growing up that was also kind of like, it was before convenience stores. So yeah, you know, soda and chips and light groceries and, you know, cigarettes.
Was
all
it
those,
open on Sunday?
No, there's no way it was open on Sunday.
Yeah.
We have blue laws then still.
Right, right.
You had to go, if you wanted to... If you wanted to get liquor, if you wanted to get beer on Sunday, you had to drive outside of this.
To a different county or something?
Yeah, you had to drive out to, I think it was Lake Timberline was the closest one. It was like probably 10 miles away from us, and it was a tourist area out in the county
sure.
property.
And they were open on Sundays.
And they were open on Sundays just because they were a grocery store that sold bait and
yeah.
all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And it had, you know, meat and everything, and you could go. But even our grocery stores were –
Right.
Were,
well,
I mean,
when gas stations would be closed on Sundays.
Oh, yeah. I
mean, right, which is like unheard of nowadays.
Oh, yeah, my dad owned a gas station
before. The only thing that's closed on Sundays in the United States now is Chick-fil-A.
Banks.
Yeah. I mean, what else is closed on Sunday? Like nothing.
Oh, there's a, well, I mean, all the government offices are closed.
Okay, so the government, the banks, the post office.
Yeah, and then
and Chick-fil-A.
No, there's other stuff that's closed. I mean, like usually salons are closed.
But most retail stuff's open.
Yeah, most retail stuff is certainly open.
So, but anyway, I guess the point from this is that it's just fascinating to participate in that culture for a while and be like, wow, this is a different, interesting, and maybe more healthy way of living life than what we do in the United States. And it's not actually less efficient. Right, it's just slightly divided.
I like everything but the not drinking wine at night.
Oh, well, they might drink wine at night, but I think the focus on drinking wine is in the middle of the day.
See, I'm definitely in favor of that. Now, if there was a culture that got up and had some wine, and then they had wine with lunch, and then they had some more wine at dinner, that's where I need to move.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Well,
which, okay, now
I'm sure there are places this where you can
now
do that.
Now we're going to switch
to Vienna,
or not to. Not so much just Vienna, but just in general, Austria. I was in rural Austria, kind of on the edge of Vienna, a little village town called Trumau, where the International Theological Institute is. And two things I'd say about Austria. I never thought that I would meet a person that liked pork as much as me. And I met a people. like pork as much as me or more. It's like everywhere you go,
everything's pork.
You can get sausage.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm waiting for the train. Oh, here, I think I'll have a sausage and a glass of wine. I am not kidding. I went to this place called Obi. It's OBI. And it's basically Home Depot. They sell all the same stuff
like
as
the
Home
Depot. Dog in Garfield?
I guess, yeah.
I think it's OBI. OBI.
Yeah, they call it OBI. And OB. And everyone says Obi, but it's OBI.
It's like Home Depot.
Yeah, and it's orange. They sell all the same stuff. It is the Austrian knockoff. I mean, for all I know, it might be owned by Home Depot.
Sure.
Right? And out front, where we would have like that little hot dog cart, they have this permanent wooden like kiosk that has like 30 different kinds of cured pork products. Like all these room temperature sausages, cold sausages, these meatloaf things that are like hot. They have like big slabs of cured bacon, all this stuff. And you can get all of that in sandwiches or just pieces by the pound. And you can get glasses of red and white wine in a real glass and beer right in front of Home Depot. You could like get a glass of wine.
This is making me think about one of the things I had in Rome that I took a picture of. I like to take pictures of my food when I travel.
Yeah,
me and too. I think you'll appreciate this one.
Oh, that is gorgeous.
So this is
prosciutto di Parma.
Yeah. So I went to this beautiful restaurant and with some friends. It was absolutely wonderful. And for our appetizers, we had this prosciutto with this beautiful fresh mozzarella ball.
Oh, yeah.
And then wild game meats. So on this platter.
Oh, you're killing me.
This is like boar sausage and boar bacon and other wild game meats that I don't even know what they are.
Dude, I'm in pain. That is beautiful.
It was wonderful. And then right after that, for my main dish, I had spaghetti with clams. And there had to have been 150 clams in my spaghetti. It was absolutely fantastic. So the food in Rome is very good, but you have to kind of know where to go and be willing to pay for it. I'm not a big fan of their pizza, actually. A lot of people like the Italian-style pizza, and I really appreciate American pizza a lot more.
Oh, what are you talking about? I love Italian-style pizza.
It's like super thin crust. It's kind of like having pizza on a giant pita bread and with a lot of cheese and not very much sauce usually, and maybe not even a lot of cheese. It's just like I don't know what the big deal is about this. And they don't really do toppings very well, I don't think. So,
okay, there, here.
But I did like the pizza that had gorgonzola cheese on it.
This doesn't include the cold stuff. That is in front.
Oh, wow.
That is in front of Home Depot.
Wow, there's like a sausage that's like 3 feet long.
It's like 17 kinds of sausage.
This is one in front of Home Depot?
That's in front of Home Depot.
Holy cow.
So Austria, you get mad props.
What does it say? Knoblauchkranzel?
You can drink everywhere too.
Cabanossi?
Just on the street. You can get a sausage, big bunch of mustard.
So the shortest sausage in this whole display is probably about 2 feet long.
Yeah, when you get chunks off of it, you know? It's so good. So Austria,
Is that like 140 a pound or what? I'm not gonna give you that whole sausage for one.
No, yeah, no, it's like a pound. Yeah. Yeah, this
or a kilogram.
Like that,
I don't know. It wouldn't be a kilogram. That'd
this,
be a lot of
yeah, that no block kronzel yeah. that you're talking at, that was the like the garlic sausage. So wow. good. So yeah, so the other thing, there's this sausage and pork everywhere, and you can drink everywhere in Austria. Like if you're waiting for a train, if you're just standing there waiting for a bus on a corner, there is a little Wurst stand, and they have beer and wine, and you can just stand there right there in front of God and everybody on the street and
drink.
We
can't talk about Roman cuisine without talking about espresso and gelato.
Right? Okay.
So, I mean, we were talking about this before we started recording about the Roman style of drinking coffee, which is bizarre. You said that the Italian government controls the price of espresso.
I've heard that was the case at one point. Yeah, well, they would revolt. I mean, that the cost of espresso was controlled by the government.
Right. So espresso isn't very.
That
expensive.
Might be an urban legend.
Espresso isn't very expensive in Rome. It's about maybe €1 to €2, depending on where you go or whatever. In Rome, you know, and I was only in the downtown area. I wasn't out in the sticks, but. The idea is bizarre to me because you basically go into a coffee shop which sells basically coffee and maybe cigarettes and maybe like a couple other things, but not a whole lot. And you stand at the counter, you pay them your euro, you drink your espresso, and you leave.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of thing where you go in, you sit down and have a long conversation with a friend, or you pull out your laptop and start working. In fact, a lot of them will charge you a fee if you sit down.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
some of the American tourists get caught off guard because they'll go to like some really nice place like Piazza Navona, and they'll sit down and start drinking their coffee, and then a 10 euro charge will show up on their bill, and they're like, what? And it's like, well, you sat in one of the most premier places in the whole city to drink coffee, and you were expecting to only pay 1 euro to do that? But
okay, Vienna is the exact opposite of this. Vienna – you go to I went to Cafe Diglas, and it's right off the Graben, kind of over by St. Peter's Dome, right? And it's a real we in America would think this is a fancy restaurant, right? White marble tabletops and these big torts, soccer torts and stuff, but you go in there and I got a little cup of coffee. And they bring it on a little silver tray, a little cream and sugar and stuff. And the coffee's not very good in Vienna. I wasn't impressed with it. It's all over-extracted, super lungo espressos that you didn't put a bunch of sugar in. But – and I had a glass of wine. I mean, I think it was like 5 euro total for both. It was like barely 2 euro for a good glass of Grüner Veltliner. But you could just go in there and sit at a beautifully upholstered booth, taking up the whole booth. And sit there and sip and drink and read your paper, and people are hanging out. And I spent 5 euro, and they weren't rushing me at all.
So I would say the difference in Rome would be you would probably pay more for your meal or your drink or whatever, but they actually expect you to stay there for a long time. So, for example, I had dinner one night, and we stayed at our table for 3 hours, and there was and the idea is, you know, in an American restaurant, they try to get 2 or 3. Sittings for every meal, right? At a busy restaurant in Rome, one.
Wow.
Right? So you're expected to occupy that table for the entire dinner time.
Wow.
And that, to me, actually made me feel so comfortable. They don't give you the bill unless you ask. Literally, they won't give it to you unless you say, hey, I want my bill.
Right.
And so I had another lunch where we sat at the table for 2.5, 3 hours, and nobody even glanced at us to, like, can suggest that we might move along.
Well, lest we end this podcast without something slightly deeper. I have to say that I had a lot of blinding flashes of the obvious as I was going around Vienna. Pater Edmund Wallstein, Michael Wallstein's son, who's a Cistercian monk over there, took me around Vienna. And there's something existentially disconcerting. Now, just for the record, this was my first time abroad ever. And so that wasn't the case for you, right? You've been over. Right. You've been around. when you realize you're sitting in a building having a cup of coffee, and the building you're sitting in is 3 times older than the country you're from, that is kind of existentially disconcerting.
Yeah.
And then there's also the other blinding flash of the obvious is when you see these epic, giant buildings that are beautiful and permanent, and they were built long before your country was around.
Sure.
And they've excavated under one of them, and hey, there's some Roman fort that they're excavating. You can watch them excavate this Roman fort, and it hits you. You knew this, but you're like, oh, yeah, civilization didn't start in the 1950s in America.
Yeah, well, okay,
and it's not dependent upon us to exist, right?
I would say that I had similar experiences in Rome, you know, encountering art that literally was made in the 300s.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
I saw some of the most early Christian art in the catacombs of St. Priscilla. Absolutely stunning, you know, artwork, frescoes and stuff. But my sense of the culture in Italy was and this might sound kind of strange, but like a culture of curators.
Yeah.
It's almost as if the civilization itself has died, and there are these people left over who are the curators of the artifacts of the civilization that was once there.
Right.
And so they're like, yeah, we're happy to serve you gelato and espresso and give you guided tours of these places, but we're not actually the best days are behind us.
Well, I mean, it's like I remember Francis Schaeffer talking about this line that was crossed in the 1930s, and then it was crossed in Europe before here, where it's basically we just abandoned our way of life. So Europe, you have this culture that is just as Catholic as anything you've ever seen. There's churches everywhere, clergy everywhere,
right.
And what like less than 9%.
Oh, in Italy, it's
no one goes to Mass anymore.
It's 4% of the population, 4% of the Catholics in Italy go to Mass on Sunday.
Right, and when you look at it from the outside, the place is just swimming in Catholicism.
Right.
But it's all kind of a history lesson. It's all just, like you said, this curator thing.
Right.
You know? And it's in America.
I mean, Rome used to be the center of power in the world.
Right.
And you could
forgive them for having a curator mindset to their culture. They are curating Rome.
Right.
I mean,
right. It's not important.
It's like
please keep
the
curating.
Birth of Europe.
It's important.
I mean, it's huge, right? So, but it's interesting to see that how blatant that is.
Yeah.
We kind of abandoned everything and we tear our old buildings down for the most part and put a car park there, or we remodel them and say, we've made this building look like it did over 50 years ago. Right. No one was alive 50 years ago. I mean, it's like we have this cult of the new, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I loved. I love that you turn a corner in Vienna and just real fast. I'm out in the Graben. I come out of this Starbucks. Yes, I went to a Starbucks. Don't stone me. I hate Starbucks. I needed to charge my phone, so I paid for a tea. And so I went and charged my phone because 1,000-year-old cafes don't have outlets. So I go to the Graben, and there's this huge monument with all these statues climbing up and down the monument. And it's a monument to the Trinity. In thanks for a deliverance from this big plague that happened. And then when I was touring Heiligenkreuz, that Cistercian monastery, in the middle of the courtyard, there's another big old giant tower, like that same style, that Baroque style, all this like statues falling and crawling up all over the place. And it's like, oh yeah, they built that because there was a plague. And it's just like, you're in Trumau, I was going to the grocery store. I just turned the wrong corner walking. Oh, here in the next to a elementary school is a 600-year-old giant tower of statues and all these people, you know, angels crying and playing and falling off the edge of the statue. It just, I mean, you're just surrounded by this beautiful, permanent, epic history. I don't know. Anyway, I suggest it.
Well, yeah, go. Europe is a wonderful place, and we should all visit there and learn about the place where history comes from.
Exactly.
But if this podcast doesn't end, who knows?
The Ghost of Eddie Izzard is always like right behind our podcast.
Yeah, right. But anyways, if we don't end this podcast, it will become epically historically
long. So go to Europe,
long.
Eat more sausage, eat...
And drink some espresso.
Drink espresso.
And eat some gelato.
But stand.
Pistachio.
Stand when you drink your espresso. If you're waiting for a train, look for some place to sell sausage and wine. These are the lessons from Europe.
These are the tips.
They're all culinary and alcoholic.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. This has been another episode of the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Giestrick.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.